It is Saturday, September 20th, 2014. We are broadcasting live from Santa Cruz on the central coast of California. This is KUSP Public Radio 88.9 and KUSP.org. And ladies and gentlemen, it's time now for Geek Speak. Typing. And welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gaps between geeks and the rest of humanity. Please keep in mind that the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KUSP or any of the geeks affiliated organizations. And good morning. I'm Bonnie Jean Primshin, the host chair today. And with me in the studio is Miles Elam, software engineer and political junkie.
Good morning.
Lyle Troxell, software engineer, amateur photographer, and father of three.
Hello.
And also Ben Jaffe, who for some reason I don't have up here, so I'm scrolling very fast. And Ben Jaffe, who
I don't know
is
what I
all
do.
Around good guy. You've disappeared completely.
I just get sick and come on the radio.
Well, okay. You're a professional software developer, right? Or are you a teacher?
I guess I'm kind of both. Yeah. I'm officially a teacher now.
Woohoo!
You're teaching the masses now.
I have to say, after 7 years of doing the show, I've gotten sick many times and my voice has plummeted down to this level several times. It's never been on a Saturday.
Oh, are you sick right now?
I'm sick, yeah.
We're all just going to have to take it for granted that that's really Ben.
I'll just cough into the mic or, you know, something.
Yeah, I'll leave a present for the next person who uses that mic.
Right.
Yeah. Well, we've got lots of stuff to talk about today. Lyle's came in with a lot of stories. Ben's got some things to talk about. How about you, Miles?
Yes, indeed I do.
Where's all your stories?
Well, my stories were on Feedly.
Okay.
Feedly is where I always keep them.
What's Feedly?
Feedly was where I put all of my RSS feeds after Google Reader. Okay.
All right. So it's one of those services that concatenates RSS, which is really simple syndication, allows you to pull information. It's actually how podcasting works, is on top of that same framework. Mm-hmm. So you have a whole bunch of news feeds from different websites that you follow, and those condense into a continuous reading system where you can kind of go, oh, I like that story. I like that story.
Right.
And read
so
more.
I save them for later as I go through, and then at the end of the week I look back and go like, oh yeah, these are the highlights, these are the ones that seem the best. Yeah. Here we go.
Sounds
this
great.
My news.
Great. Like okay, so let's hear some stories. What do you got?
So I had this weird occurrence happen
recently
where I was plugging my phone in because it was getting low on battery, and it started acting weird. Like my reminders app started launching and started scrolling, and immediately I looked at that going like, wait, am I being hacked? What the, you know,
yes, this seems
like something out of a hacker film, you know,
right,
like where the computer starts doing things.
Yeah, it's like
you
movie
it.
Style.
Yeah, it did look kind of like that. And then I hit into airplane mode. I'm like immediately like cut it off,
disconnected from the network. Okay.
Yeah. Nice.
And it was still happening.
Uh oh. Like, oh, virus. Was it a virus?
Well, that's the thing though. It's.
Sounds like something wonky with the touch interface
right.
to me.
But it only
hardware failing problem.
But it only when I connected up to this particular charger. And so like,
wait, so it, how is
this
a
USB, elaborate dog
a
ate
USB
my homework
charger,
story?
A USB charger.
What's
yes.
happening?
And I wasn't sure. I'm still not sure what's going on with it. I'm just being very cautious right now. But at the same time, I was because
wait,
I was being
wait,
cautious.
Wait, isn't that white charger you had last week you were bragging about?
Yeah.
It was cheap, everybody. So my guess is that thing is putting out a high-frequency interference that's causing problems with your touch surface.
Yeah.
Touch
uh-huh.
So
but
you,
at, but
when
at any
you
rate,
do,
at the time, I was like, okay, this can't happen. This is not acceptable. So I immediately went on to Apple's website, changed my Apple ID password.
Good, smart.
Made sure that my secret codes were ones that people who did some Google searching on me couldn't know the answer to.
Yeah.
So you took all the precautions.
Yeah, went on to Gmail, changed my password there, and I have two-factor authentication on there.
Do you have that on Apple as well?
I turned it on, except that it says you have to wait 3 days before it goes active. Really?
Yeah, I know. It's so frustrating. Ben, I went through that.
Yeah. And then I went in and, you know, updated my apps that are on my laptop. And I'm like, okay, everything's fine.
Great. And then you came into GeekSpeak?
And, well, no, last night. Then I realized, oh, I left my charging cable at work. Oh, my wife and kid are out of town, and they took their charging cables.
Okay, so your phone died. That's not a big deal.
except that that's where two-factor authentication works. So when I tried logging in again to get access to some of these resources,
not so
it
much.
Was asking for my the text
the
message.
That, okay.
Yeah.
So that's the whole danger with two-factor authentication. You are not you until you know something and you have that thing, and that thing's working.
Right.
Your
yeah,
phone ran out of power, so it didn't work. Now,
this is exactly the scenario you were talking about
last week.
Right?
Yes,
well,
you
but
be
I mean, like all these things had to happen.
Yeah,
I had
but,
to lose
but,
it.
Miles, you also could have just dropped your phone in the toilet. People do that, you know.
Yes.
So the same thing, kind of thing, can happen. Now you can print out backup codes for the, just this purpose.
Actually, what I have done is with Google two-factor.
Those are with my wife out of state. That's what I wanted
nice
to say.
Safe.
Oh, great. With
two-factor authentication, once I got back in, once my phone was back in, I put in a backup phone number. So
yeah.
There's the primary one, and then I set my wife's phone as
yeah.
the other one. So
smart.
Chances are we're not both going to drop our phones into the toilet at the same time.
You could go whitewater rafting.
Just don't paint the bathroom together. That's all you
right.
got to do. All right, so two-factor authentication, if you're doing it, well, first off, if you're not doing it, it means really bad things for you probably in the future, in the near to distant future. You kind of have to start getting into two-factor authentication. That's the way to do things. But even an expert geek can run into a problem, so be very careful. When they say, print this out for later use, print that out and know where it is. And actually,
yeah,
I would
idea.
Recommend...
Yeah.
You take that two-factor, give one of those codes to someone you really trust and ask them to put it somewhere private, not digitally, most likely.
If I had not changed my password
mm-hmm.
at that moment.
Yes. Yes, we
it
know that it was
fine.
We know that it was an arrangement of a wonderful happy accidents.
But those apparently happened.
They happen a lot.
I don't know why that gives me so much joy. I'm sorry that happened to you, Miles.
So the long and the short of it is, Miles' amazing preparation was almost in vain. But now you're back in, everything's okay. Because I actually had a charging cable for you for your phone, right?
Yes.
All right, so we're all good. And pretty soon you'll have some stories for us.
I'm also really annoyed that Apple Lightning cables are so expensive.
Yes, you should get a cheap one online. And then it can cause problems with your device.
I love that this is sort of a loving circle of
yes.
people.
Yeah.
Is that what you call it?
It did have me thinking of USB condoms.
That's a real thing, you guys.
What's,
yes.
What's that?
Yeah.
In other words, putting a device in between that only allows charging but does not allow data syncing.
Because the fear is that you'll get a power brick from China and it might have some malware on it, and then you're potentially in trouble.
And then you'll reset your password. It won't really be the case, but then you'll reset your password and you'll get locked out of your devices.
Right. But at the same time, there was a proof of concept a year ago that I looked up that was saying if you have this, you can have something that is the same dimensions as an Apple, power brick for an iPhone, type of thing. And you can infect that with malware and you can have it.
So the other thing you could do is just carry a USB extension cable and open that up and disconnect the data lines. That way, it's very short. There's nothing active in it, and it's just power.
Yes, if someone has the ability to do that.
That's not easy to do.
Right. So
you're wrong. It is very easy to do.
Yes. Well, which cord do I cut?
The correct one.
Okay.
Wikipedia USB B, and you'll see which pins. It's pretty easy.
Why don't you just come over and do it for me?
That's not easy.
Or... the easier way is you get one of those battery packs, those portable battery packs that connects through micro USB, to charge, and then you plug in your phone through that.
And you hope
that
they manufacture it so the data line doesn't go through. You don't know necessarily.
Well, no, if it's a Lightning device, it's not going to get data over a micro USB.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, the Lightning device there too. It's actually probably safer than USB. You don't need a USB condom for a Lightning device. You just need a $400 cable. Mm. Should we go on to other stories, please?
Anyway, sorry about your plight, Miles. Oh, guys, you know what? Notch Pearson's, what is he? He's selling
the
Minecraft.
The original creator of Minecraft.
Who
that's right.
That?
Yeah.
The creator of Minecraft is getting outie.
Yeah. So the story lately is that Microsoft is buying Mojang, which is Mojang. I don't know how to pronounce
Mojang.
It.
Mojang. Let's pretend it's Mojang.
Let's pretend it's Mojang, which is the company that did the development and creation of Minecraft, one of the most popular and successful games in the world. And they are getting it for about $2.5 billion.
That's money.
That's money. And the reason is Notch, as Marcus Pearson, as you just mentioned, kind of is done. He wants to retire his relationship with running that game. I mean, this game, Minecraft, was hacked together as a side project for a period of time, then decided, it'd be kind of fun to actually make a game, made the game. But even in the early versions of the game, it wasn't as much a game as a playing area. And that fundamental's always been in the game. And now there's a whole genre of games around this idea of sandboxed games basically because of Minecraft. I wouldn't say it was the first by any means, but definitely the most successful.
Yeah, and you can definitely
the world by storm.
Yeah, and you can definitely tell the age of someone by show them a puzzle like a hangman type of thing with the M and the FT at the end with a bunch of blank letters. You ask someone who is under a certain age and they go, "Oh, Minecraft." Yeah, someone over a certain age, and they say Microsoft.
Well, now both of those are handled under one company.
Thing. Nice.
Yeah.
The first time I heard of Minecraft was on this show, and Ben had a story about someone rendering. Do you remember what it was, Ben?
The Enterprise D.
Yes.
Nice.
I love that you know which version
and
the Enterprise.
It wasn't full scale. It wasn't full scale. I think it was like I think it was 3/4 scale. Which I wondered.
Well, what they did is they had every deck of Enterprise be 2 meters, so 2 blocks, right?
Yeah.
So that's what
yeah.
the scale was.
Because,
but really, a deck is probably a lot more than that.
Well, I don't know. I mean, we don't
by
have...
By all means, let's figure out the technical details.
But you know what I love?
Just to be,
we talked about Miles' password problems for 20 minutes. Why not?
Just to be clear, there is a technical reference on this.
Yes.
And I have owned it at one point, and I don't know where it is.
Okay. But Microsoft D, I think we'll be able to hold our breath for that.
If I find it, I will bring it in, and we'll leaf through it together.
Okay, so...
Fantastic.
So the Minecraft game, I don't know any child right now that's not addicted to it. I mean, it's an amazingly cool game. One of the reasons why it's such a engaging thing is that... You can play in a mode that's non-dangerous. It's non-combat. There's no scariness to it. You're invulnerable, and you have full creation capabilities.
Yeah.
And it's a 3D world that you can create things in. That's basically what it is. You were going to say?
I have a 12-year-old friend who has made a gigantic monument of herself, like a statue of herself in Minecraft.
My daughters do giant pigs, really big.
Just there's something exciting about just making huge stuff.
Yeah. Anyway, if you haven't played Minecraft, it's kind of a fun thing. Microsoft's bought the entire thing. I'm kind of interested to what Notch is going to do next. I'm assuming that something else will come out of it. Now, there are other games that are doing sandboxy. The one that I'm interested in is called Rust. And Rust is currently in a beta. But it's, imagine a high-end rendering first-person game where everything's highly detailed, beautifully crafted. Mm-hmm. And a game system. The game is you start in a field naked with a rock. And go. And it's much more realistic.
Wow. That's
and,
neat.
Yeah, you build foundations. And anyway, the development of the game has been going public. It's been public the entire time. So they've released blog entries about how the game's being developed.
Oh,
it's,
that's cool.
It's wonderful.
Yeah.
And that's from the same guy, Gary, who made Gary's Mod, another game engine that's been popular in the hacking world of creating your own games or the making world.
Cool.
Do-it-yourself gaming.
So now Minecraft can live on under, you know, gigantic company tutelage.
Oh, you know they'll totally break it.
They might. But it's okay because Notch Pearson's going to go off and make other cool things and maybe he'll share them with us.
And one of the things that's interesting about Minecraft, because it's a Java app, you can you can decompile it and actually get some knowledge out of it, and that's why there's so many hacks on it, because the decompiled version is extensible and you can actually continue to develop in it. Mm-hmm. And so with this giant culture of creating mods to Minecraft, recently that's been changing, but in general it's still a vibrant community where people will modify the game and produce another game inside the game. And that's kind of cool. I used it in presentations, hacking JavaScript inside Minecraft. So cool platform. Very cool
that
platform.
That is really cool.
Highly cute. And we'll have links to not only the news about Mojang going over to Microsoft, but also Notch Pearson's goodbye letter at our website, geekspeak.org. You're listening to GeekSpeak here on KUSP. And if you're enjoying this program, consider checking out the 7th Avenue Project, which airs Sundays at noon at 88.9 on your dial, or as a podcast in the talk section of KUSP.org. Every week, the host talks with a bright mind in the arts or sciences, and we all get to listen in. That's the 7th Avenue Project, Thinking Persons Radio, with Robert Polly, and it airs tomorrow at noon on KUSP. You can also check out their website at 7thAvenueProject.com. Right now, you're listening to Geek Speak on KUSP. I'm Bonnie Jean, and with me in the air room is Miles and Lyle and Ben. And Ben, I've been hearing about this thing called Alibaba. It sounds like the Chinese version of some other popular site. But
as
I haven't
quite
got my head around it yet.
Yeah, it's kind of like Amazon, kind of like eBay, but kind of different as well. So the idea is if you want to produce a lot of something, right?
Mm-hmm.
One way of doing it is to go to China, find a company which specializes in this, have a bajillion of meetings with them and all of that stuff, and then eventually they'll make your thing for you, right?
Right.
And they'll contract out to all of the various companies in China that make all of the sub-things that make up your widget that you're building, right?
Yeah.
Alibaba kind of turns that on its head. Instead, it's... actually, here's a good connection. Etsy, the website Etsy. Instead of going to...
You might have to explain that to people.
Sure,
well,
sure.
Etsy is for the crafty set. You can sell your finished crafty items, but also craft ingredients, basically.
Have you figured out to make a really cool item, like knitting something? Let's say you really make, like, really well socks, right? Knitted socks.
Yeah.
You have a little business where that's what you make. You make a page on Etsy, and you say, I sell socks, and anybody that wants wool socks finds you, and you purchase them directly.
And this can be anybody. Anybody can set up a page on Etsy and start selling things. Right, you don't have to be necessarily a big company to do this. And the idea is that Etsy is kind of a very, very thin layer of middleman between the consumer and the person producing the thing, right? Alibaba is kind of that way for a whole bunch of things, right? There are some differences between Etsy and Alibaba, but that kind of gets the idea across. So instead of going to some massive Chinese company to have them produce widgets from a bunch of other pieces, instead you can go through Alibaba and find all the pieces yourself, and then you can manufacture those things yourself.
So if you wanted to make massive sort of scale models of the Enterprise D.
Right. Yeah, that would be a great way to do it. So like things that you can buy on Alibaba, you can buy 200,000 really small screws, right? Mm-hmm. That's one thing you could buy. You could buy a whole bunch of – I mean actually they also have really large things. They actually had I'm not sure if it's still up – but a 747, I think, mm-hmm. a gigantic airplane that was used that you could go and you could buy and they would ship off to you.
So there's a range.
There's everything's there.
Range. It's, sounds like everything.
It puts Amazon to shame also in its craziness.
Really?
Right? So, for example, because, you know, on Amazon, one of the things that infers its successfulness is its ability to sell it. Mm-hmm. And therefore, and it's consumer focused. This is not consumer focused. This is based on other things. So, for example, I just search for hair weave, you know, like hair. Yeah. And you can get different types of human hair. You can get plastic hair, whatever. There's 21 million products about hair on Etsy right now.
Gee.
That's a lot.
Yikes.
Community theater is going to go bazonkers.
I know.
Oh,
with
my
all those wigs.
That's true. That's true.
So why is Alibaba in the news right now?
Well, it's the U.S. IPO for it is a lot of money. A lot of money. So we were talking about Minecraft and that whole thing being bought by Microsoft. Mm-hmm. It was $2.5 billion,
I think.
Think two orders of magnitude bigger.
Two orders of magnitude
$231 billion is the U.S. IPO for Alibaba. So that is massive. That's bigger than Amazon and eBay combined.
It's also the biggest U.S. IPO ever.
Yes, and it might be the biggest IPO ever.
Second only.
It might be.
What do you mean? It's a U.S. IPO. They're only becoming public in the U.S. What does that mean?
I would say I don't know.
I'm not sure exactly how that works either. I'm not.
We're not finance people. We're geek people.
But but it actually could be the biggest ever. There is an option that underwriters have to buy more shares, and if underwriters do that, then it actually might get higher than $22 billion. Wait, hold on a second. Anyway, it might become the biggest one.
Oh, I see. Numbers. If it gets more investors. That's right. More investors come in.
Yeah. Sure.
So I guess get in on that if that's your thing.
I guess so.
And it sounds like there's a very good chance that something on Alibaba is your thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. And let me just say that right now on Alibaba, there are 385 products when you search for USB condom. So there you go.
There we go.
And by the way, they are all USB memory sticks that look like packages of condoms that you rip apart.
What?
That's fun.
Go to geekspeak.org to find that.
Oh my God,
that's
we're
true.
We're going to link to that. Yay.
Lyle just turned his computer around. It's
right.
True.
I suddenly got very interested. All right, let's talk about another big company, eBay.
Yeah, and actually this, I want to bring this up because I want to bring up and talk about the idea of phishing and how you protect yourself from it. This is phishing with a...
That's right. If you're a fish, you do want to protect yourself from phishing.
That's true.
Yes, but that's true also.
So
this is another kind of
that's
phishing.
That's a different
show. So Bonnie, give us the lowdown on what phishing actually is.
I don't actually know.
Really? Oh, okay.
I get confused between phishing and catfishing.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, then here's what we talk about when we're talking about phishing with a PH.
Okay.
And it's simply the idea that it's a social engineering practice.
Is this the practice thing where you pretend to be eBay or PayPal?
Yes.
Got this a bunch.
Yes.
And then somebody sends you email and they're like, oh, we're PayPal. You need to change your password. Click right here.
Yeah. It's called phishing because generally you put out these lures that look like certain things.
Yeah.
You direct people to those lures and they might bite. And if they bite, what they do is the general concept is you make a page that looks a lot like eBay login.
Yeah.
And then
you
get people through email or through other means to go to that page. They're like, oh, yeah, I want to log into eBay. And they start putting their username and password.
Well, the eBay logo was there. It must have been eBay.
It looks just like it. It's very hard to distinguish.
Yeah.
And so the In fact, Google recently released an email filter that would pull this kind of thing out from email more effectively. Uh-huh. There's a type of character that's a character type that's hard to see. It's a type of encoding, and you can actually put a link that looks just like eBay, but really there's an invisible character in the middle of it, and it's a different site. In any case,
it's called Watermark.
Yeah.
Also, this is why we've been saying for years and years, don't click on links in emails, right?
Yeah.
You can go and open a new tab and type in the thing manually.
So that's right.
But never, ever, ever click on the link, because it might not take you where you expect it'll take you.
That's right. So if I make a page that looks like eBay exactly, mm-hmm. and I get people there,
yeah.
that getting people there is the tricky part. After that, you're gonna trick people. It's pretty easy.
Yeah.
Okay, so can we do like a two-sentence rundown of the difference between that and catfishing? What's catfishing?
Well, catfishing, all I know about catfishing is you go to like Louisiana and you fish.
Okay.
Is there a different,
there's
a computer term?
There's some sort of techie term for catfishing.
Miles, Ben, do you know a techie term for catfishing?
No.
I wish there was some site we could look that up.
Oh, well. We'll never know.
I'll let Ben look that up. Well, I say
let's move on.
That BBC recently had a story, an investigative story about eBay having a lot of phishing scams inside the site. Now, what eBay allows you to an end user to do is create a store. And if you're a buyer or a seller, right? If you're a seller, you can have a store. And on those stores, you can add links and text and JavaScript and Flash to your store.
So people are phishing within eBay as their own individual little company.
Right. So what they're doing is they're creating a little little store on eBay. Oh. They're putting for sale an iPhone Plus, or iPhone 6 Plus for cheap. Yeah. Someone goes there and they click on it. As soon as they click on it, it actually goes to a different website or opens a form, and that form collects their email information, their eBay information, and steals it. And so this phishing scam, the problem with it is it's a embedded feature. It's a cause-effect of embedded feature inside eBay. So this is really tricky because when we say don't click on an email, go to the website directly, well, of course, in the website, clicking around makes sense.
Yeah.
Well, at eBay, you got to be careful. And what I'd recommend is you go to eBay, you log in, then don't log in again, even through the website if you're using eBay. Don't then log in again to eBay. If you want to log into eBay, visit ebay.com. When that loads, log in there.
Yeah.
And it's a little tricky to explain this to people. So I'm hoping that eBay will turn off these features. They have a crack security team working on this.
Yeah, I'm sure
but
they do.
As we know about security, it's really an arms race. You know, people figure out new ways of doing things bad.
It's on. Cat and mouse.
Yeah.
Here we go.
Yeah. They shouldn't allow scripting or Flash to be uploaded by other users is the issue.
So first Craigslist was over.
No, Craigslist isn't over, is it?
Well, this happens. It's like a janky version of that happens on Craigslist.
Oh,
someone goes, here's the best apartment in the area for cheap, cheap, cheap. And you click and they're like, oh, we're out of town right now, but can you send us funds? And this?
Right.
You know,
or
they get your information.
Yeah.
And just take all your money.
Catfishing. I figured out.
Yes.
And it took some Googling. I don't think a lot of people are using this term, but if you spell catfishing with a PH instead of an F, it says this recently coined term refers to false online identities created by internet scammers to deceive people into a long-term romantic or emotional relationship.
Oh.
So it's kind of the same thing, but a little bit different.
So catfishing is to produce a relationship with someone in a phishing methodology.
So is that like when you pretend to be like the pigtailed buxom whatever, and then you get yourself a little romantic situation?
Interesting. So
why
catfish? I see, because it's kind of like on the prowl. Funny, I figured that out quick. Yes.
It's like cougars, but different. Okay. Well, now I learned a couple things.
Cougars are a cat. It's good.
Now, Miles, I'm noticing more and more that there's less of an emphasis on owning the music and the software and things that you own and leasing it.
Well, leasing is also a curious term for it, because there's usually when you have a lease, you have a very clear sign of like, yes, I can use this for this period of time. And
it's all murky. And
most of these end user agreements have things like, we can cancel our agreement at any time at our discretion.
Reads those? And, whatever.
Right.
With or without notice.
So is Congress getting involved somehow in this whole shift? What's happening?
Congress has, or a member of Congress has introduced a bill to modify how we interact with the Digital Millennium Copyright Act.
Okay.
And
The Digital Millennium Copyright Act?
Yes.
Okay, what's that, first of all?
This was the bill that most responsible for bringing copyright into the digital age.
Okay.
It was passed
around the millennium,
imagine. Around the millennium.
The Digital Millennium Copyright Act, one of the side effects is that you are not allowed legally, if anybody puts in a security feature, the process of figuring out that security feature or breaking it or passing code around that explains how to break it is illegal.
That's one part of it.
So yeah. Knowledge even of that is illegal.
Ooh, that gets slippery.
And it's caused bad side effects. So yeah. I can basically give you anything and kind of wrap some software security around it. And if you look at it or do anything with it, you could be prosecuted by that.
Right. And a lot of the issues people have been talking about with jailbreaking a phone or unlocking it have been covered under the Digital Millennium Copyright Act and going back and forth. And whether Librarian of Congress will make exceptions for that, Librarian of Congress being in charge of making copyright rules.
Okay. So what's Congress doing now?
So they're looking at doing something called a Yoda Act, the You Own Devices Act.
Oh, okay. I thought it was involving, you know, changing around the grammar of agreements.
Right. It's kind of saving the first sale doctrine, because software has always been in a large case, the end user license agreement says this is non-transferable.
Okay.
You buy it, you install the software, and then you can't resell it to someone else. Now, this comes into a problem when you have a device that requires that software to run. So you sell a device, but legally the other person can't use it because the software license is non-transferable. And so how do you deal with that?
That sounds like a glitch to me.
So what this is doing is trying to end what the EFF calls a one-sided and abusive end-user license agreement aspect.
Right. Yeah.
And saying that if you have the right to use this device with the software on it, you have the right to be able to sell or transfer those rights, including the device en masse, you know, as a unit altogether to someone else.
Yeah.
We'll see how this works in the long term. Right now, it's just the bill. It's not a law. But at the same time, if you're interested in this type of thing, you can always call your Congress critter and let them know what you think.
I think we should own what we own. I think it's ridiculous,
the idea that you don't own the insides. That's
silly.
Yeah.
Especially as more and more products require the software to run them. I mean, it becomes, without access to that, you don't really own the device.
Well, I've been talking with someone about this at work and various other places online, where if you have a DVD, you can transfer ownership of that DVD, not just selling to someone, but I can say, hey, you can borrow this.
Right.
And then I don't have access to it for 3 days or whatever. Yeah. And, you know, assuming they give it back to me.
Right. Yeah. Three days is pretty optimistic.
And then they give it back to me, and then they lose the right to be able to use it, and I regain it.
Yeah.
And as we get more into the software age where there is no physical...
It's copies of copies and you can download.
Right. You're streaming something and you have the right to that, but you can't transfer the ability for someone to look at, you know, your Netflix account for 3 days while you don't. And then
I may or may not be sharing my Netflix account with someone and we can watch things concurrently.
Yeah. And not to include someone who's there, not to single out Netflix, but I mean like your Amazon Prime or Google Play. Like these are all things where it really does change the way we think about sharing, and just sharing is kind of short circuited. Like it's just not built into the business model.
Right.
And it's not necessarily the fault of the Netflixes and the Googles and the Amazons, because a lot of the content providers are putting these rules into place, saying this is the only way we're going to allow this media to be produced.
Okay. It's about wanting to be paid for what you've created.
Yeah.
So, I mean, the debate gets interesting. And so now EFF is in on it. They're working toward making the bill pass.
Well, we definitely would want it to pass. It's a perfect gambit for EFF to support. It's one of the reasons why, instead of keeping abreast of all the social rights issues around software and technology, instead of figuring out each one of them and addressing each one of them, you just read the EFF and give them money.
Yeah.
Because they're doing it for us.
Yeah. So we're going to have a link to the EFF topic about this, the sort of presence on the web talking about this, and then you can decide what you want to do about it. You'll find that at geekspeak.org.
And because we're just throwing out EFF, Electronic Freedom Foundation.
Yes.
That's what it means.
And it's EFF.org. They have a nice short domain.
Electronic Frontier Foundation.
I get it wrong all the time.
I know. I always say Freedom, and it's actually Electronic Frontier. And their way makes more sense, but my way...
That's what it feels like to you.
Yeah.
It feels like, yeah.
They're fighting for our freedom.
All right. Now, speaking of things that are often manipulated...
This is a weird in the frontier.
Segue. In the frontier, the space, perhaps.
Yes, I know where you're going now.
Nice.
I'm getting
nice.
Catching up. Say the word moon, and I'm totally there.
let's talk about whether or not we actually landed. Of course we did.
Oh, we did.
Oh,
when
no.
I mean,
for
oh,
some reason, this debate, like, first, it's not
so. Because there's a whole foundation of people that think that the world is flat. I mean, people are stupid. Yeah. So, yes, we landed on the moon, of course. We landed on the moon in 1969. The Apollo 11 moon landing had photographs. Now, one of the things with the photographs that's always been intriguing is if you look at them, they just seem odd.
Yeah.
And of course they seem odd. They're on another planet.
Right.
So, yeah, they're odd.
Another body, yeah.
Another
but that's
body.
Been used as like, see, they didn't really go there.
Right.
It's
manufactured. And that's stupid. But the issue at hand, there's some thought in the film. There's like, you're in the shadow of the sun and you're on the I think, I don't know who it is that's actually ascending the ladder in the photo I'm thinking of.
Buzz Aldrin.
It's Buzz Aldrin
standing
on the ladder. Right. And,
because someone had to take the photo,
yeah.
Which would be Neil Armstrong, because
yeah.
he was the first
Neil
one
Armstrong
out.
Is taking oh, yeah. the photo, and Buzz is climbing down the ladder, I assume. And now Buzz is in the shade of the craft,
yeah.
and therefore there shouldn't be any direct light on them, but he's illuminated quite well.
Yeah.
The other thing that's odd about the photo from our human perspective is that there's no it's dark out, but there is no stars visible in the photographs.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And so the reason for this has to do with apertures of cameras and exposure and reflected and refracted light. And lots of talks about this, and it goes on and on and on. But
there have been quite detailed technical discussions of this.
Sure.
You can find them online if
yeah.
you are so
But don't
curious.
Spend time doing that because you're wasting your time.
We
landed.
Enjoy
there's
your life.
Photographs from Earth with telescopes of things on the moon we put there.
Yeah.
So stop it. We've had flybys of crafts that have taken photographs and seen flags
yeah.
and footprints on the moon. So, yeah, it's over, okay?
And given yeah. that this is an ongoing debate.
So lately, a wonderful company, NVIDIA, makes graphics cards, made kind of a think of their new graphics cards with using this story. And what they did, now they have two new graphics cards, the GTX 980 and the GTX 970. And I'll give you the stats real quick on this. 4 gigabytes. Of frame buffer memory that's running at 7 gigahertz.
Yeah.
That's a lot. Now, I've been not paying attention to graphic cards for a few years, and it's just
kind
of tripled last time I've looked. Anyway, the clock speeds for these things are 1.2 gigahertz, which is impressive. And there's 2,048 parallel cores.
I remember when we had like 8 cores.
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
Oh my
8 cores.
Anyway, these things are massively powerful devices that spit through voxels like mad. Now, the thing that they've had in this new technology, in this new card, is called the voxel global illumination. And this concept is, instead of using point, well, NVIDIA's GeForce general manager say, quote him,
okay.
Global illumination is the hardest task to solve as a game company. He continues, virtual point lights don't do a bad job when the environment stays the same, but a game developer has to fake shadows, for example.
Yeah.
So there's all these tricks. Well, this global voxel illumination allows you to have every surface also have a light reflective capability. So they completely modeled Armstrong's suit. And Armstrong's suit is the reason why we have a fill light there. He's standing in direct sunlight. His suit is extremely reflective.
Yeah.
So they took the reflective material of that suit, put him in the scene, and rendered the thing perfectly.
Wow.
And sure enough, they got pretty much what you'd expect. They got the photo that looks like that he took a long time ago.
Well, that must confuse things entirely. Like,
not
yes,
at all.
This
awesome.
Is a reproducible photograph.
Well, the thing is, you can always just... now it's reproducible completely. Yes.
So.
Totally true. We can emulate it now. Now, the thing is, you can also kind of tell that the moon surface... They didn't do the moon surface. They did everything else. But.
Okay.
There is one other aspect to this. And congratulations to NVIDIA for this. And they are pushing the boundaries of...
Of the tech.
Yes. Of basically recreating physics in a virtual world.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And I still also think of the story we did a little while back, which was we had the tech to get to the moon in the late 60s.
We don't anymore.
We didn't. No.
Go ahead.
We didn't have the tech to fake it.
That's right. That's right. Yeah, that's kind of cool.
The movie technology
also,
was not sufficiently far enough along to be able to do
we're
like CGI and stuff
there.
Like
that's
that.
That's what NVIDIA
says. I love Buzz Armstrong's response when he was
Buzz Aldrin.
They are just one too.
Buzz Aldrin's response when someone said, "You didn't really go to the moon." He just punched him in the face.
Yeah.
I think that's
him.
The appropriate response to that question.
Such a badass.
And then the judge, when the guy sued him, when he came forward, and the judge was like, "Yeah, justified.
You deserved it."
Yay.
Also, that story is he was kind of the guy who was asking the questions was kind of being, but he was harassing him. He wasn't just like, "Hey, did you guys go to the moon?"
No. Right.
He was harassing. Like, "Yeah."
Right. He was getting in their way, and
he was standing in their way.
Would not listen to them when they said, "Please leave us alone. We're trying to get to where we're trying to go."
Yeah. Rude. People are rude. We're not so rude. We're going to tell you very politely that it's time for a break here at GeekSpeak. This is GeekSpeak on 88.9 KUSP and KUSP.org. I'm Bonnie Jean in the host chair with Lyle, Ben, and Miles, and we are talking about all kinds of stuff. And hey, as we are recording this, as we are here on the air live, it is Electric Car Week. And it sounds like they've done something
What's Electric
celebrate.
Car Week?
It's Electric Car Week.
Well, I've got a cool story about them. I didn't know it was Electric Car Week.
Oh, yeah. There's some little festivals and stuff going on where they're showing off electric cars here and there.
Wasn't
one in Cupertino, one in Capitola.
Wasn't it Talk Like a Pirate Day yesterday or something?
Yes.
It was.
It's a busy time here for celebrating.
I love the pirate jokes. Anyway, so...
back to the electric cars.
Electric Car Week. So we now have a new world land speed record for electric cars.
Is it like 60 miles per hour?
No, actually.
That's mean.
It was 60
miles...
Flintstones
cars, electric cars.
It was 60 miles per hour in 1898.
What? Where were even cars in 1898?
For an electric car. Yeah, we had really, I guess, not so great electric cars.
I think he's making this up, folks.
No. I'm on Wikipedia. Wikipedia never lies.
Sorry, you've got your cold brain on. You're looping.
Uh-huh. No, I'm loopy.
All right. So Wikipedia says 1898. Of course, as we all know.
1898. Well.
If it's there, it must be fact.
I just changed it, and then now I'm quoting it.
Okay.
So, we're now over 200 miles per hour for electric cars, which is pretty awesome. 200 miles an hour.
But how long can you go 200 miles per hour? That's the question.
That's true.
About like 1 hour.
5 feet.
Yeah.
No,
one hour journey.
Yeah, they did qualifying rounds, which are at least 1 mile, actually. If I find it, I'll mention it.
Wait, but in fairness, how far can you go at 200 miles an hour with a gasoline
vehicle? That's a good point, too.
Guzzle gasoline at that.
Your fuel efficiency goes down pretty fast.
A fair comparison is all I'm asking.
But anyway, yeah. So congratulations to the BYU students who did that, Brigham Young University students.
Oh, okay.
And they had all worked on this car back in 2011, and they had set the world speed record for electric cars back then at 155.8 miles per hour.
So basically Brigham Young is like the boss of speedy electric
cars. I guess
cars.
So, yeah. So anyway, over two qualifying rounds, 204.9 miles per hour. Pretty darn fast.
And this is National Drive Electric Week. It started the 15th, went to the 21st. And today in Cupertino, actually right now, there's the National Drive Electric Week event. And what they're trying to do is do the world record for the largest electric vehicles in a parade.
Oh,
hopefully
that's fun.
They will achieve that.
Nice. One thing. And then they're all going to do the Thriller dance.
No. Now, electric cars may be great and everything, but I just want to throw out this number that jet and rocket propulsion cars.
Woohoo!
That record is 763 miles per hour.
Oh,
over 1 mile.
That's
so,
not
no,
driving.
I have all the respect for people who are willing to strap themselves into these
rocket
machines.
Yeah.
Oh, people have to be in them?
Yeah.
Oh, that's horrible.
But, I know. Like, why would anyone do this?
But at the same time, the fact that there are wheels on it doesn't seem to matter that much.
Actually touching the ground.
Yeah, actually, part of the rules is they can't leave the surface. The wheels have to stay contact. That's the hardest part of those high-speed things.
I imagine it would be.
Because you want to start flying.
Yeah. Yep. Just go straight up.
Try running in a pool sometime. You'll start swimming. You
know, but the thing is, with normal cars, it's the wheels that are providing the drive.
Exactly.
With a rocket-powered car, the rocket is providing the drive, and the wheels just happen to be touching the ground and providing friction.
Friction, yeah. They're, like, not actually turning, maybe.
Okay,
I don't think they're very efficient with regards to energy usage.
Fine, then. Internal combustion engines around 400 miles an hour.
All right.
A bit more respectable. But
it is. Of course, that's not the way we're going.
No.
Self-driving electric cars, you guys.
We really shouldn't be going 200 miles an hour or faster in cars ever, I think.
We really shouldn't be going 50 miles per hour when controlled by a human being.
That's true. Wait, don't you work at Google?
Yeah, wait a minute.
Yeah, I do. But at the same time, you know what?
People are bad
drivers.
I don't work at Google. I agree with you.
I know people who are like, ugh. That's their response to the bad traffic out there, or just like idiot moves is, where's my self-driving car?
Yeah.
Or the fact that a little bit of rain landed on the road nearby and it was the first rain for a little while.
Yeah, but there were so many accidents.
Yeah. It turned Highway 17 into a parking lot. And it was like, why? Because you guys didn't expect that when it got wet that maybe it you would should be slow
that's
down?
That's a lot to think about.
But it's also like they accumulated. Yeah. Anyway,
it's rough. It's just that humans are not as good as at what they think they're good at. Basically.
Sorry, humans.
Humans are horrible logic machines. I'm sorry.
Yes.
And that they're
good at pattern recognizers. Like patterns. I've been driving 60 miles an hour along this mountain road.
I'll just keep doing that.
I'll just do that. Oh, it's raining? Oh, well, I hope I don't.
Anyway. It would be a shame if for the entire season of non-rain, oil had accumulated on the surface, and now it's not on the surface and it's floating instead. It's no problem with that at all.
So wait, what are we even talking about here? Self-driving cars are awesome.
And rockets.
Let's just move on. Yeah,
this is like an anti-human fest here.
It is. I frankly am looking forward to our robot overlords. all right, let's talk about Apple a little bit here. Apple, they had a thing.
Yeah, we should do some stories.
Shall we? They're a big company. We talked about eBay. We talked about Alibaba.
Yeah.
What's going on with Apple?
I played with a new iPhone yesterday.
I did too, as a matter of fact.
Yeah, it's kind
of
cool.
Yeah. Okay. Well,
nice. It's a lot like a Nexus phone.
Well, the 6 was just at the limit of what my hand could handle at one hand.
Yeah, I didn't play with the 6 Plus, actually. I only played
the 6 Plus when I held in my hand. It was ridiculous. Like,
if you've just tuned in, we're talking about phones.
iPhones. Yes.
The iPhones that are bigger
no way,
than the previous ones.
There's just no way to use it one-handed unless you have the hands of Andre the Giant. Like, it's just,
or a table.
What are we talking about again?
You have hands like a table?
No.
So iPhone put it on 6. The table. No. In any case, let's talk about Apple news besides that.
Right, okay.
All right, so
but in other news,
yeah.
Apple's warrant canary disappeared.
What's a warrant canary?
I didn't know they had a warrant canary.
I love these things.
Yes.
It's the best thing ever.
So, Homeland Security has, or FBI, or any of the other similar law enforcement agencies, have told organizations saying, we want information on XYZ person or class of people or whatever.
And sometimes they do that with a warrant.
Mm-hmm.
And that warrant stipulates things.
Yes. And some of them have said, you are not allowed to tell anyone that you got this warrant.
Right.
Oh, that's the worst.
Right. Right. So here's a warrant. I want this information on Miles. You cannot tell anybody. I even came here and gave you a warrant.
Is this a real warrant or are you fishing?
So these are exactly. That's one of the things you have to do. In fact, a lot of law gets fought in that space of, is this real? And the check and all that stuff.
Right.
And most companies do. So what do you do about that? If you want to inform your customers that if a warrant's been issued, what do you do? Yeah.
Because if you do publish that information that gets back to you, you go to jail for a very long time. And you're
So what do you do? So what is a warrant canary?
So Apple had a transparency report on government activity in late 2013. And it had a section at the bottom that said, quote, Apple has never received an order under Section 215 of the USA Patriot Act. We would expect to challenge such an order if served on us.
That was the line in the release document.
The idea being that if they ever do get such a report, they can remove that line because so far, I mean, in theory,
the canary.
Yeah, in theory, the courts cannot or law enforcement cannot compel you to lie.
Okay.
They can compel silence, but not lying.
So just to really kind of bring home the metaphor, they had this line as sort of like the health of the warrant situation.
Yep.
And by removing it, they have subtly told their customers, by the way.
Yeah. Another great one of these you'll see sometimes at libraries. It'll say there'll be a picture next in the back somewhere, a little photo or a little printout that says, we have not been issued a warrant for your information. Uh-huh. And then underneath that says, keep an eye on for the removal of this sign.
Yeah.
Okay. So now, that's what they do. So Apple basically recently lost that line in their document.
Right.
Okay, so
and
now
that,
we know something.
We know that there was a warrant, but
that's the thing, though, is that we everyone got up in a flurry going, oh, my God, oh, God, look. And because warrant canaries had never been tested in court, everyone was also kind of
ooh,
like,
now
hey,
what's going
to
happen?
What's going to happen? What's going to happen?
Precedent being set.
It turns out, it says people have found out that the latest report says that it has not received any orders for bulk data. So it's not this big, you know, umbrella trying to catch a whole bunch of information.
Okay.
But also, Ars Technica was suggesting that the disappearance may be the result of Apple following Justice Department guidelines that actually do permit companies to publish ranges of surveillance requests.
Right. Which is a much better way of going about it, obviously.
Yeah, as long as the figure reflects a combined number of FISA requests and NSL requests. In
right.
other words,
so,
they can't say individual ones, but they can say that they were.
Which is actually probably more informative than something happened. Like, that's all we'd get from the canary. You know, oh, there's badness going on. Instead, now they can say, yeah, we've issued this many FISA requests, and this is how many we responded, and some little bit of stats. So more Apple news, if I can continue the Apple stories.
Yeah, please.
One of the things that I wanted kind of, I'm excited about what Apple's doing with regards to hardware and security. Apple actually has part of their chipset in the iPhone is an area of space that is not accessible in the normal way. And there's one of these for the digital rights management system, the encryption area.
Wait, are you talking about a TARDIS?
Exactly.
The Apple TARDIS.
When you run software and you're running on a hardware and you have the rights of an admin, the highest level, the root's rights, you have access to all the memory space of the entire machine. You can access any space. And that's why that area is really dangerous, because if you have a virus that can do that, they can access the machine and so on. So when you're dealing with something like your iPhone and you've got data in there like your contact information, technically your some authentication things represent who you are, that stuff, if some rogue application on your machine also gets access to your machine's full root capability, they can read that space. So Apple does a really good job at a software level of restricting access at these different areas, and they keep improving that. It's kind of painful for developers, because when you put in restrictions for security purposes and privacy purposes, it's harder to develop in it. It's not as easy, and that's one of the side effects. But Apple's got some improvements in iOS 8 and also in the iPhone. In iOS 8, they're also allowing developers to use part of their security protocol, and that is the approval that your thumbprint was scanned. There's the whole Touch ID thing, and that basically, what's interesting about the Touch ID is that ID information of your fingerprint doesn't actually ever leave your phone. In fact, it doesn't even leave a hardware-combined encryption module inside the hardware. So the software machine can't actually get access to your footprint or even your fingerprint signature, which is actually what it's compared against. Mm-hmm. And that is really cool. Hardware-level isolation is like the only way to do it in a safe way. Now,
if your phone falls in the wrong hands, they...
Right, yeah. I mean, basically, when you approve your phone, you log in. Every time you boot the phone, you have to log in with your real password. After that, that password is encrypted, and that encrypted SIG is inside this hardware-supported Touch ID system, which can then access it to authenticate. Not fully, but actually process stuff through it. So it's, I don't want to get into the full details because it'll bore a lot of the audience, but it's an amazingly tricky and clever way of dealing privacy and security.
And the end result being?
The end result being you really can trust the system, and you really can trust that that fingerprint was real. Now, we could fake the fingerprints, but it's hard to do. But the point is that the phone, even if someone get malicious code that totally overwrites the software, which happens all the time in some respects, they still can't get access to that. And that is really cool. Apple's also extending that feature off to any developer that wants to use it. And they're starting to kind of use the encrypted aspect of that on the entire device. So when you use an iPhone, if you're using a passcode from initial state, you got to start off that way. The entire drive, the entire hard storage is encrypted. It's accessed unencrypted.
So you mean like as soon as you get your fancy new phone?
Yeah, the data is never written in a non-encrypted way, which is very cool. Okay. And if you're not using like some syncing service, it stays on the phone. Mm-hmm. That encrypted thing, the lock for that, the key for that is inside that little piece of hardware management system.
Okay.
And you can't get to it via software. So you now your passphrase actually, of course, is the master password, if you will, of all that encrypted data. You lose that passphrase, it is gone forever.
Yeah.
Unless, of course, you do an iCloud backup, which in which case they share it to that service and you can recover it. But the point is, doing it in a certain way, it's one of the rock solidest pieces of hardware we have for privacy and security, and it's available to everybody that has more than $1,000, just like ridiculous like that,
well,
the cost
great.
Of them. So
but,
I'm excited by it.
Now, does that mean it's not searchable either if like people are, if the authorities are hand over your phone?
That's right. Without you giving up your knowledge. Now, that's one of the things about your thumbprint. You can be compelled to use your fingerprint to unlock it, but you can't be compelled to use what you know. So if your passphrase is relatively good on your iPhone, and someone's about to incarcerate you or something, make sure you turn your phone off, because when they boot it, they'll force for the password, and they can't force you to do that legally.
Well, that's actually an open question for.
Well, there's been court cases in which passwords have been.
There have been people who've been held in contempt of court and put in jail because they didn't give up their passwords.
Interesting, yeah. Okay. Well, so it's an open space, yeah. In any case, we're going to see a change to how authentication works because of the phones. Because now if you have this kind of space that's protected by your thumbprint and a master password and all your passwords can be in there, it starts allowing you to do really cool things. So the password managers now in iOS 8 1Password and LastPass are both able to use this feature and logging into sites, including a Safari plugin, which allows you to modify Safari on the fly, makes these password managers a lot easier. So if you've got a new iOS 8-capable iPhone, especially with a thumbprint system, I'd highly suggest you switch over to some password management software like 1Password or LastPass. There you go.
There we go. Yet another reason to do one of those things, LastPass or 1Password. Do we have time for just like a quickie? I kind of want to talk about the FCC chairman. He was a lobbyist for 30 years.
Well basically, AT&T and Verizon when they talk about broadband, the current guidelines say 4 megabits per second is broadband.
Okay.
So slower than that is not, but if you do 4 megabits per second, then for the purpose of tallying and surveys, then you can say this percentage of the population has broadband, this percentage does not.
Okay.
The FCC chairman has said, yeah, no, broadband is, we're going to call it 10 megabits per second because people are using streaming services and stuff like that, and 4 megabits per second just isn't
enough. That's not sufficient. So, okay, he knows things.
Upgrades.
All right, that's fine. Well, you've been listening to Geek Speak here on KUSP. This is Public Radio for the Central Coast, 88.9 KUSP Santa Cruz, live online at KUSP.org. To find out more about this or any episode of Geek Speak, please visit geekspeak.org. And thank you for being here. I'm Bonnie Jean Primsch for Miles Lyle. And Ben, thank you for being here for our September 20th, 2014 episode.
It was a pleasure, Bonnie.
Of Geek Speak, yeah. Thanks for having me.
See you next week.
Bye.
See you.